The following program is a co-production of New Jersey Network Radio and the New Jersey Historical Commission. It was made possible in part by grants from the New Jersey Council for the Humanities, a state partner of the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the New Jersey Historical Commission. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect those of the Council for the Humanities, NJN Radio, or the Historical Commission.
$14.65 out of 20.
The face of America is changing. Stop at a gas station or convenience store in many parts of the country and you will get a glimpse. More than ever, America is becoming a home to people coming from India. Few Americans see more than a stereotype. About 800,000 Asian Indians now live in the United States. Some are doctors, some are cab drivers, some Hindu, some Muslim. They speak many languages. But, as we will hear in the next hour, they do have some things in common. As they strive for success, they struggle for acceptance. As they embrace America, they hold on to India. The greatest concentrations of Asian Indians are in California, New York, and New Jersey.
Guru Nanak was born in a village named Talwandi. A beautiful Gurdwara stands at the place of his birth.
A Glen Rock, New Jersey temple or Gurdwara. Fathers in turbans and moms in traditional Punjabi dresses are teaching children who already know their MTV Sikh history, language and religion.
It is called Janam Astam. Or the sacred birthplace.
Nankana Sahib is now in Pakistan. No one from India can go there freely. It is very sad that we are not free to visit and see our dear and sacred place.
The Sikhs were the first East Indians to immigrate to North America around 1900, just a handful at the start. New York University historian David Reimers.
They generally were male, overwhelmingly so. And they were mostly agricultural workers, sometimes also working in canneries or maybe in lumbering. And they worked in Canada down and crossing over the United States. As they came in, racial hatred and hostility began to build.
The Sikhs were greeted with the same animosity that resulted in the exclusion of the Chinese a generation earlier. By 1917, says Professor Reimers, Congress had imposed what was known as the Asiatic Barred Zone.
It did it by drawing a triangle, a big area in Asia, and all persons coming from that area were to be barred from coming to the United States.
During the 1920s, America nailed shut a door that was already closed to East Indians. Congress established quotas limiting immigration from all parts of the world except Northern and Western Europe. It was an attempt to keep out anyone not defined as white.
The word race was not used with immigration law per se, but for naturalization purpose, the word white was used.
Under a law dating back to 1790, only white persons could become naturalized American citizens. In the 1920s, a Sikh immigrant named Bhagat Singh Thind challenged this law. He was granted citizenship on the claim that he was a Caucasian, a vague 19th century concept theorizing that Indians shared common roots with Europeans. But in 1923, the U.S. Supreme Court revoked his citizenship. In effect, the court was saying Mr. Thind may have been a Caucasian, but he was not white.
And in fact, after that decision, the United States government began to denaturalize some of those Asian Indians who had been naturalized. It was, you know, quite an incredible thing to go after people and take away their citizenship.
Aber wir werden auch die nicht vergessen, die den richtigen Weg einschlagen.
World War II made America rethink its immigration policies. Confronted with Nazi racism, with India and China at America's side fighting the Japanese, the Asian restrictions became a diplomatic embarrassment. Again, historian David Reimers.
The war comes, and of course, with China as a lie, the argument used for diplomatic reasons, we've got to change the immigration law. It's an insult to our ally. And all of these things came together, and in 1943, we repealed the Chinese Exclusion Act.
Then, after the war in 1946, the liberalization was expanded. Congress passed the India Act. The immigration of East Indians to America had resumed. The door was ajar. But it was a small quota which had to be shared with overseas Indians living in Africa, the Caribbean, and South America.
Growing up in British Guiana in those days, I think my parents really never espoused us to follow through with the Indian tradition.
George Moonsamy, raised in South America, is a chemist now living in Tabernacle, New Jersey. He arrived in 1958, an era of assimilation, when immigrants were expected to Americanize as soon as possible. It was not hard for him. His family had become Anglicized in British Guiana.
I think that when I first came over here, I sort of identify myself with trying to become an American to fit in the mainstream society and sort of ignore my background, so to speak.
Moonsamy succeeded, married an American, raised two daughters. Camille Moonsamy grew up in the New Jersey suburbs. She says she felt like a regular American kid, except for her name.
I can remember just waiting for the name to be said, like the first day of school or over the loudspeaker or something like that, and just getting a pit in my stomach because everyone would turn and snicker, and they would rarely pronounce it correctly the first time. Usually it would have to be corrected. And what made it even more difficult is they did call me Cammy, so Cammy Moonsamy was a difficult name to have.
It's no longer difficult. Recently, around the time of her father's 60th birthday, Camille made a conscious choice. She would embrace the Indian side of her ancestry.
And I was trying to think of what I could get him for his birthday, and since he has everything that he needs, I decided that I wanted to sort of recognize the fact that he's given me this Indian history that I'm just really starting to discover. And I went and had a sari made. And the woman in the store saw my last name and said, oh, yeah, you're Indian, you don't look Indian, but started asking me questions about my father and how I was raised and if he had married an Indian. And I just found it really interesting that she related to me, even though I really don't know anything about the way she lives, but we had something in common there.
Why do you eat?
Camille now finds herself in an America where there is growing sentiment to celebrate one's ethnicity rather than hide it. In some circles, it is now fashionable to look Indian. Traditional painted body decorations are worn by teens and rock stars. The Indian community has now reached critical mass.
Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom.
The turning point was the 1965 immigration law, which abolished the discriminatory quotas. Again, David Reimers.
And you get the 1960s to the civil rights movement, you know, the whole climate, an attack upon racism, the general attitude about the desire to do something about inequality in America society surely plays into this.
No more slavery. No.
Under the new rules, 20,000 East Indians would be allowed to come to America each year, actually more under a preference system that included the unification of families. The law also gave priority to immigrants with special job skills.
How so? Well, 65, you also pass Medicare and Medicaid. And you create a huge need for doctors and medical personnel, rather than nurses and so forth. And this was one of the ways in which so many Asian Indians began to come in. They came in as doctors, a few as nurses.
Many of these highly trained Indian professionals got jobs in urban hospitals and settled in old industrial cities.
I went to Usmania University. It's one of the premier universities in India.
Dr. Lalitha Mason, a gynecologist from Hyderabad in South India, immigrated in 1966, settled first in Trenton, New Jersey. Today, she practices medicine in Hoboken and Jersey City, across the Hudson River from Manhattan.
I arrived in a sari, you know. And I at that time, I remember I had very long hair, you know, and I used to go in Trenton. And I was like, to the kids, you know, I was like a curiosity, you know. The kids would look at me, they'd admire it. But then they brought about, you know, ill feelings later on.
Mason believes that the ill feelings grew in part from jealousy.
When the Indian communities started developing, and they saw them being dynamic in the community, buying up houses, you know, all the rundown neighborhoods were being revitalized.
In September 1987, the local newspaper, the Jersey Journal, published a hate letter it had received. The letter threatened the Indian population of Jersey City with violence.
Jersey Journal wasn't very sensitive either. You know, they published it in the front page headlines. They will go to any extent to drive the Indians out of town.
The hate letter was signed by a group calling itself the Dot Busters.
They coined it themselves. The letter said Dot Busters, you know, so because the Indian women wear the dot, they coined it themselves.
The dot was a reference to the bindi that Hindu men and women place at the center of their foreheads. The dot marked the Indians as targets.
And that's when, you know, whoever wore the dot, they're going to bust them.
On September 27th, Navroz Modi, a 30-year-old bank manager, left a cafe in Hoboken.
Teenagers attacked him, called him Hindu, abused him, kicked him, and then he succumbed to those injuries.
Then, in October 1987, another incident. A young doctor named Kaushal Sharan was walking in the Jersey City neighborhood known as the Heights. He was attacked and beaten with a baseball bat.
And he went into coma, and he still, you know, has, you know, persisting injuries from that. He never totally recovered.
Dr. Mason says Jersey City officials failed to respond adequately to the attacks, so she began to organize street protests.
Every day there was some incidents, you know, somebody's beaten up, somebody's spat on, somebody's kids in school was being abused as being dog busted. Police had gone to the mayor's office. There was no response. Until we demonstrated like the Mahatma did. And I remember a day when we closed down Journal Square. You know, I had about 3,000 people there. And New York Times had it on front page. And that's the, and then came the biggest bigots in history, which is the BBC. They flew down to interview me.
The protests and press attention motivated the state legislature to pass an Ethnic Intimidation Act, toughening the penalties for hate crimes in New Jersey. While arrests were made in these two crimes, there were no convictions.
We are standing here right behind us is one of the big grocery stores known as the Royal Grocery.
A rainy day on Oak Tree Road in Islin, New Jersey. It's a suburban business district transformed by a second wave of Indian immigrants. Not the professionals who arrived in the 1970s, but mostly business people from the state of Gujarat on India's west coast. Pradeep Kothari owns the Quick Travel Agency. He took producers David Cohen and Marty Goldenson on a tour of the shopping strip.
Right across we have saris and dress stores known as Kalaniketan. Next to there is Ravi Jewelers. Most of the here is a lot of jewelers. Indian community use a lot of jewelers.
Like diamonds and jewelry.
Yes, 22 karat gold. So there is all kind of different stores are available for the needs of the ethnic community. We have just walked from my office to here on Nina Jewelers. It is one of the oldest jewelry store, and their owner is Mr. and Mrs. Praful Vaid. And besides that, they are very active in a community activity and participate and support the all activities.
How did the Asian Indian neighborhood come about in this town?
Oh, okay. When I moved into this town, it was a very rundown town. There wasn't hardly any stores here because most of them were empty stores. And that's how we started, because it was very cheap to rent a place in this place. And then over the years, it's just like escalated to a stage where it's totally Indian businesses in this area, almost like between 60 to 70 Indian businesses, which has developed over the last like 4 to 5 years. We spent the initial years trying to maintain the town and, you know, go through all the problems that each and every town, when you get into a new town, that has. So we actually went through all those steps, and finally we have a very stable, nice community here.
Do you have any trouble with vandalism or anything when you moved in?
I have actually been involved in an incident myself. Some guy, there's a bar that is opposite my store, and guy just jumped the fence and attacked us. because basically there were two or three of us standing in the front of the door, and they didn't, you know, it's being a new face in the community, they didn't like us. There was only like 3 to 4 stores at that time in this area. So that's one of, and they, I mean, you know, we had, I had a broken, just above my eyebrow, I had some bruises and things. And my neighbor here was attacked. He was hit with a baseball bat, and he suffered a little bit more than I did at that time. But, you know, it's something that we went through, and we are glad that we've cleaned up everything now, and it's much more stable environment here now.
Are weddings a big part of the business?
Wedding plus certain occasion like a Mother's Day, Christmas, and then Valentine, everything like that.
And are there some traditional Indian gift-giving days?
Yeah.
Such as?
Like a Diwali. It's the biggest. Like a bigger than even Christmas.
So other days?
Other days for like a Navratri.
Yes, the festival.
Right, festival. There are so many places they are coming from.
So it's not just simply the Oak Tree Road neighborhood?
Customer. No, not local customers.
You mean people travel for hours and hours to get to this store?
3 to 4 hours.
Now, what do you have that's unique? Why would they travel so far?
Like they get Indian stuff, like Indian jewelry. Usually we say we wear sari and Punjabi dresses. So American jewelry is not suitable for our Indian dresses. So they come for Indian designs.
You know, the Indian culture is, in a way, if you look at it more inside into it, you will find that our expenses are very limited outside. Like, we hardly go out drinking. We hardly go on vacations. We save money to buy gold. You know, that's a fact of life in Indian community.
It's a sense of security also, because the gold, you can always trade in.
Exactly. That's, I mean, you know, if somebody buys gold, they look at it in two ways, to enjoy it and to be an investment at the same time.
A lot of people who buy gold, and historically, did so because they felt insecure in the communities they were in, as if maybe they would be unwelcome one day.
Like such a thing happened in Uganda, so it can happen to this country also.
I speak about 5 languages, sir. I speak Gujarati, I speak Punjabi, I speak Hindi, I speak Swahili. When you are born in other countries, sir, you have to learn more languages.
Suresh Dalal, a lawyer in Woodbridge, New Jersey, was born in Kampala, Uganda, where thousands of Asian Indians had settled, originally part of the British colonial administration. They saw Uganda as their permanent home.
The Asians in Uganda were the business people. They were in trade, they were in professions, they were in judiciary. Particularly every branch of the government, the Indian, Asian Indians were in Uganda playing a very important part. They played a very important part in commerce.
The Indians in Uganda were important, but to President Idi Amin, dispensable. In August 1972, he announced that all Asians, including those who were citizens, would be expelled. Dalal was among them.
And he said, "We are traitors, and we should be thrown out from this country." When Idi Amin made this pronouncement, I was in Uganda. And I went to India because my family was in India at that time. So I decided not to go back to Uganda, because I was hearing these stories that there was a lot of atrocities were committed and a lot of people were killed.
Did you think of yourself as African, Ugandan?
I thought of myself as I was a second generation people, and I thought of myself as a Ugandan. I never wanted to come to the United States. I had roots in Uganda. I was born there, my children were born there. Uganda was a really beautiful place. It was really beautiful, I tell you.
Wonderful. Nice to meet you after a long time.
Yeah, it is a long time.
Where are you and where have you been?
I've been around. I'm not too good.
You're not coming to my office, and I don't see you.
I was thinking of coming up there.
Yes.
But you're always busy. I don't want to bother you. You know, when you're trying to not only take care of your own business, but the whole business district here.
Well, someone has to take a responsibility, right?
That's true.
Central New Jersey is not Uganda. The Gujaratis who run the shops are not being expelled by the government, but they do not feel secure. Town officials, they believe, are harassing them by means of local ordinances. You can hear the problems resonate in the back room of Patel's Grocery on Oak Tree Road, just down from Nina's Jewelry. John Pappas, a sympathetic local landlord, feels the town has saddled the Indian merchants with excessive health and building inspections.
The Indian merchants were willing to come in and put some money up and put up, you know, nice businesses like Mr. Patel did here. He fixed the whole inside of the building. He put in new plumbing, new electric. So a lot of money has been spent down here, basically by the tenants. But the town somehow doesn't seem to realize it. I don't know whether that's it's a cultural problem or what, but it would be nice if the town fathers treated everybody equally and just give them a chance. Don't keep them under a microscope all the time.
The harassment, the violence, the vandalism on Oak Tree Road in Islin, New Jersey, led Pradeep Kothari, the travel agent, to organize a merchants' association and to do something else, to make a statement that Asian Indians were here to stay. He launched the Navaratri Festival.
It's a festival, name is like that. It's done whole night in India. It's now means nine, and Ratri means nights. It's a nine nights of festival. After the farming season is over, all over the country, every street, every corner, they have a people has a music going on and people are dancing all night outside.
The first year, the Navaratri Festival was held in a local school gym. Now it's celebrated in the neighboring township of Edison in a tent-like structure the size of an armory.
Here we go. Ladies and gentlemen, Navaratri 97, Friday night, with Bhakti Art Academy.
On the first Friday night of Navaratri, boys in baggy jeans and girls in saris are dancing around the statue of a goddess, Amba. The all-night festival gives strength to Amba in her battle against the demon Ravana. An ancient battle between good and evil, which lasted 9 days, is reenacted in the nine nights of the Navaratri festival. The dancers click special sticks together. Some are the traditional wood brought from home, others day glow plastic, $5 a pair.
This is called Dandiya, and they're part of the celebration during Navaratri, and we kind of dance around the statues. It's kind of a praise to the gods, like we're dancing and everything, and we're enjoying ourselves. So what we do is there's a dance between two people, or you can have a huge group of people, and we all hit our sticks together in like a nice pattern, and then we keep going in circles again and again.
Are the boys terrible at it?
Not all of them. There's some of them that are really, really good, probably better than some girls.
I saw a few that were good, but the girls are all good.
Because most of the girls have been doing it since they were little. The guys are just kind of doing it now to get girls, you know.
The young people take for granted that the Navaratri Festival will take place each year, that the huge tents will spring up, transforming this industrial park into a mammoth celebration of Indian culture. But in fact, each year it's been touch and go. Organizer Pradeep Kothari says local officials have tried to scuttle the festival in a sea of red tape.
The politicians were talking sweet in front, but they were somehow did not want to do us to do that festival. So there was always a conspiracy going on.
Using legal challenges and political wrangling, Kothari has been able to keep the festival going since 1990. The fifth year was one of the toughest. Local authorities said they'd received complaints about noise. They passed an ordinance stipulating that the all-night festival shut down at midnight. Traditionally, the festival doesn't get started until midnight.
And this area particularly is far away from the residents. It is a spaghetti of highways where continuous trucks, traffic, and New York Times has a continuous trucks coming and going, and it's all night press is running, and it's not where we are disturbing anybody.
Pradeep Kothari contested the noise ordinance in federal court.
The legal ground is they had Edison Township has no business to stop us to celebrate our festival. It is a religious and cultural festival under the freedom of religion.
The judge issued a restraining order against the township and gave the festival permission to remain open into the morning hours. Ironically, when Kothari fights battles like this, it does not always make him popular in a community that often chooses to avoid conflict.
Many people still today in my own community, and I am sorry to say, they say that we are foreigners. I say, well, what are you talking about, you are foreigners? You have come legally here. You already adopted this land as your country. You have children here. You have already taken the citizenship. Many people just, they don't want to speak out, don't want to make enemy, don't want to bail the cat. By speaking out and by taking a stand on an issue, your life is not easy.
The Navratri festival in Edison is primarily a celebration of Gujarati culture, but the Indian subcontinent is home to hundreds of ethnic groups. Not all have immigrated to the U.S. in equal numbers, but there is diversity here as well.